From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the latest documents unsealed in the John Doe investigation show prosecutors allege Governor Scott Walker was part of what they say is an orchestrated effort to evade campaign finance laws. We'll break down the news. Plus, the members of Avec Le Bois talk about the trick to playing in a quintet.
Knowing when to stand out and when to blend, it's challenging to know where you fall, when do you need to come out, who's leading where and when, and then creating that balance.
And we celebrate the state's 19th century bicycle culture.
Wisconsin, to some extent, mirrored what was going on in the rest of the country. I think the thing that made a big difference here in Wisconsin was very quickly the bicycling movement equated into improvements in the road system.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening today on this cloudy and foggy Friday morning. Allies and opponents of Governor Scott Walker today are trying to make sense of the hundreds of pages of documents released Thursday in the John Doe investigation. In the documents, which were released by a court order, the details of the prosecution's case were made public, a case that Governor Walker and two associates were at the center of an alleged effort to evade campaign finance laws during the 2012 recall elections. The case involves not just Wisconsin names, but national names such as Karl Rove as well. No charges have been filed in the investigation, and since the release of the documents, Governor Walker has pointed to the ruling by a federal judge that put at least a temporary halt to the investigation. Dan Bice has done some investigating himself as a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He broke the original news that the John Doe investigation was underway and has covered it extensively since then, and he joins us this morning by phone. Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks. Always good to be with you.
Let me ask a basic question first. Why were these documents ordered to be released in the first place?
There were some media groups that were asking for them to be released. It was a little bit unusual because the civil complaint was filed and it was heavily redacted, and a number of the responses were completely redacted. So we were trying to cover a dispute without knowing everything that was being said.
Well, and this is the court system ostensibly agreed that there was some value in making public what is supposed to be by its nature a private investigation?
Yeah, I mean, that's the unusual thing. The not-so-private John Doe investigation, which now everybody knows about. You know, this was significant for a couple of reasons. The main one is the prosecutors have been largely silent for the 2 years that this has been going on. And in unsealing the documents, the prosecutor showed what they thought, what their case is all about. We also got to see in its entirety what the targets are saying is wrong with the investigation. So most of the cards have been laid on the table. There's still some stuff that was still under seal. And, of course, not everything that they've gathered is being made public. But the outline of the case that the prosecutors were trying to make is out there now, and the defense is out there now.
Is it fair to describe these, 200 pages of documents as basically a snapshot of where the investigation was when it was suspended?
It is a snapshot. I think of it more as an outline of what they were hoping to do, because you have to go into court and tell a judge that you think a crime has been committed. You have to say what the crime is and the reasoning for it. And that's what one of the major filings was yesterday. It was Fran Schmitz, the special prosecutor, saying this is the crime that we thought was committed, and these are the reasons for that. The interesting thing is there have been two presiding judges in the John Doe. The first judge listened to those arguments, said that they found it valid, and signed off on more than 100 subpoenas and more than a dozen raids on people's homes to gather information. That judge ended up leaving the case, and she was replaced by a second judge. The second judge read the information and thought that there weren't any grounds to continue the case. And so that judge quashed the subpoena. And you'll be hearing from Governor Walker repeatedly emphasizing what that second judge did, not the first judge.
And the outline of that investigation was in this the so-called Exhibit C. Give us a thumbnail sketch. These are complex campaign finance laws that were involved. What was it that prosecutors were trying to prove?
They're trying to show that during the recall election, Governor Walker and his campaign along with his chief strategist, R.J. Johnson. And R.J. is a very major player in Wisconsin politics. Most people don't know who he is, but for the last 25 years, he's been one of the key people in deciding who gets elected here and who doesn't. The argument was that these people worked together to coordinate what money was coming into the state and how it was spent. That there were 12 groups, conservative groups, to which people would make donations and money would be shifted from one place to the other. The prosecutors are making the case that this sort of coordination is illegal under Wisconsin law, and that the reason it's illegal is that people don't know where this money is coming from. If people give money to Wisconsin Club for Growth and it passes it along to another group who passes along to a third group, by the time the TV ad runs, no one knows the source of those funds. I mean, that's the argument that they're trying to make.
Well, and prosecutors are saying essentially that if one group does something on behalf of another group, they have to be listed as essentially a subcommittee of that other group.
Sure. That's part of it. And, you know, the machinations, the where the money went and how it was distributed and transferred, it was a pretty complex, they call it a scheme. It was a pretty complex system that they used to try to keep people from knowing exactly where the money was coming from.
You mentioned R.J. Johnson. The other person who shows up a lot through this is someone named Deborah Jordahl.
Deborah Jordahl has been R.J.'s top deputy for the last two decades. Where you see R.J., you see Deb, and where you see Deb, you see R.J. They worked together for a long time. They run Wisconsin Club for Growth, and R.J. is also the main campaign strategist for Governor Walker. He was with him through the 2010 election and throughout the 2012 the recall election. And if you've read the governor's book, you know that everybody thinks the governor has won the recall election, but it's only when they go in and see R.J. and they see that R.J. is on the verge of tears, everybody then realizes that he's defeated Tom Barrett.
Well, the other issue that's wrapped up in this seems to hinge on whether so-called issue ads are express political activity or if they even need to be considered express political activity. Is that right?
And that's the pushback on this. The thing is, if these groups, the question is, how independent are these groups? And when they're raising issues and suggesting people think about certain issues, are they working in concert with the campaign or not? And right now, the federal courts are in flux as to how to regulate various ads. Do you have to say vote for Scott Walker for you to be considered an independent group that needs to be regulated or not regulated? Some courts are going a number of different ways. And the Seventh Circuit, which oversees our area, had a pretty major decision in the Right to Life case, trying to loosen the regulations on these third-party groups.
A lot has been made of this email exchange between Governor Walker and Karl Rove. What's the significance of what was in that email?
It just shows that everybody knows that there was this coordination activity going on. Plus, Karl Rove plays a big hand with his group, American Crossroads, in terms of dispersing money and helping out candidates around the country. It also is great to have Karl Rove in any story. It also, you know, it's interesting. Karl Rove has connections in Wisconsin, and clearly he and Governor Walker are, you know, very good terms. They're discussing how this system is going to work during the election.
Now, Governor Walker is singled out in many of these details, but had prosecutors actually gotten to the point where they were accusing him of coordinating these alleged schemes, or is it mostly R.J. Johnson?
It's Governor Walker is at the center of it, along with R.J. and Deb Jordahl. Those are the three individuals they cite as targets in the investigation. But, you know, the subpoenas were quashed, so there's a lot of material they hadn't gathered. They had done raids on a number of people's homes. And, you know, there's a discussion of the raids in the complaint that's filed by the Eric O'Keefe with Wisconsin Club for Growth.
Right, and, right. Know, what did he say about those raids?
Well, it's the first time somebody has said on that side what exactly happened. There were pre-dawn raids. They come in, you know, with big lights and everything and sweep in, take everybody's phones, even the kids' phones and their computers, and the people whose houses are being raided are supposedly told that they can't even talk to their attorneys. So obviously that side is very upset about that, and they've included that. They've included that in their complaint. All of that information had been redacted, and we hadn't seen it. Judge Randa had referred to it in an earlier decision that he handed down, but it doesn't look good. It looks heavy-handed. The prosecutors have said that they didn't do anything unusual in this case, and it is true. Prosecutors in cases tend to, they do raid people's homes. It's just that, you know, this is a white-collar case involving election law, and so it comes across as certainly heavy-handed.
So this isn't necessarily a legal issue so much as it is a PR issue as much as anything.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a public relations issue. And also, you know, the targets are saying that this is a partisan investigation meant to shut down Governor Walker and to prevent him from getting reelected. That the investigation was started by a Democrat, John Chisholm, the district attorney for Milwaukee County. And, you know, this adds to their discussion. Look how dramatic and radical and unnecessary these raids were. But, you know, they did this in the first John Doe investigation back in 2010. So that's not, it's not unusual. It's sort of what prosecutors do. But, you know, if you're sitting at home at 6:30 in the morning and a bunch of cops show up and go throughout your house and take your kids' computers, that's not something that you expect.
One can already see the campaign commercials on both sides here.
Sure.
The existence of the investigation itself is still bogged down at court. It's been quashed, but it could potentially pick up again. Even if the investigation is allowed to pick up again, you can't make these documents a secret again. Does it cease to be a John Doe investigation at that point?
I think it's so bizarre what's going on to have a secret investigation. And, you know, also in this thing are allegations about how I got the stories when I broke the fact that there was a John Doe investigation. Everybody's making allegations about what all this material that's supposed to be secret. If the Seventh Circuit would decide that the investigation could go on and that there was no problems here, it would be very bizarre to continue it. But I'm guessing that they would ramp up the investigation and start going again. But you're right. First of all, I highly doubt that the whole thing will be resolved by the fall election. But I'm not sure how they get the investigation going again. But at the same time, you would hate to go through all of these legal fights and end up winning and then say, you know, what the heck, let's end this investigation now. Then it looks like nothing but harassment.
Do we have any idea, you know, given all of what's been released, how much this has cost us?
No, actually, the prosecutors have been very reluctant. I tried to put together some numbers on the first investigation to see how much it cost. You know, it ran 33 months, and there were substantial resources being used. And I was able to see how much the judge in the case was paid, but the DA's office was very, very reluctant to help me with numbers, just in terms of, I was trying to find out how much of the time the different prosecutors spent on the case, and they wouldn't even tell me. They wouldn't say if someone spent half their time, a third of their time, a quarter of their time. It was nearly impossible to do, but I think we're right now going back at that and trying to figure out how much both investigations have cost. We do know how much the attorneys cost in this part of the case. The attorneys for the prosecutors. So that's something that's readily available. But the investigation itself, that's a harder thing to figure out in terms of the cost.
So for all the stuff that's been made public, there are still a lot of questions that we don't know the answers to.
Sure, yeah, there are a lot of questions.
Dan Bice, thanks so much.
Sure, thanks for inviting me.
Dan Bice is a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and is covering the John Doe investigation. He's doing an online chat about it and other issues at noon today on the paper's website. Political analyst Mordecai Lee joins us now, also by phone, to talk about the implications of these released documents. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Mitch.
So with the release of these documents, Democrats are using terms like smoking gun. Republicans are using terms like partisan witch hunt. Is it possible for both of those things to be true?
You know, I suppose both of them can be true, simply because we're at such an odd point in the criminal justice system. After all, what we're used to is when, let's say, a DA brings charges, or let's say when a court issues a verdict, And then you can have multiple interpretations, but you've had some authoritative developments. What we're looking at is a kind of a half-baked prosecutor's case that was stopped in its tracks by legal maneuvering. And so we're seeing what the prosecutors think were the elements that might lead to a charge, but they haven't fully developed the case, and we certainly haven't heard from the other side in terms of a rebuttal on substance. This is such a peculiar and bizarre situation.
Well, and you mentioned the criminal justice system, but right now the release of these documents effectively turns things over to the court of public opinion in some way. How does that change the game?
Generally speaking, in politics, when there's an authoritative development, a verdict or a charge, then the spillover to the political world is understandable. Now I think it's much fuzzier, and that's why when you started the conversation, you were able to talk about these two sides depicting something wholly differently. We're seeing the tentative outlines of a prosecutor's case. It doesn't mean that anybody is guilty. It certainly doesn't mean that Governor Walker is guilty. There's an insinuation of a violation of a law, but that law itself, the law that bans coordination, is a state law which the opponents appear to believe is a violation of freedom of speech, is a ban on free political activities based on the latest decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think that might be one reason for their really unusually aggressive tactics, and that's that they want to get it to the Supreme Court as fast as possible.
They want to get it to the Supreme Court as fast as possible, but it's unlikely that whatever it is will be resolved before the November election. How is this likely to play out as a campaign issue?
I think you're right. That's where the divergence happens between the legal case and the political case. So I guess what's so different in this case is that we're not in the typical situation where one politician accuses another politician of maldoing and then the other politician responds with another attack. And it's a kind of a tit for tat. In this case, the accusation comes from a prosecutor. In fact, it comes from five DAs around Wisconsin, some elected as Democrats, some elected as Republicans, who jointly then appointed a special prosecutor. So there's a bit of a more sort of political, I should say legal heft to what the potential accusation is. But nonetheless, the governor was absolutely right yesterday when he said that there's been one state court judge who wanted to quash the subpoenas, and now there's a federal judge who wanted to freeze the case and force them to destroy the evidence. And so based on those developments, the governor can accurately say that this does not appear to be going anywhere.
At the same time, there would seem to be a lot for an opponent such as Mary Burke to use in, if nothing else, muddying the waters?
I think the situation needs to be taken much more seriously, not only because it's deriving from a prosecutor. In other words, it's not just some out-of-thin-air accusation coming from one candidate against another candidate. But because I think that the Milwaukee County DA has established a certain amount of credibility, after all, this is John Doe 2. There was John Doe 1 about political activities by the staff of the county exec's office when Walker was running for governor and was the county exec. And we have to remember that the DA in Milwaukee County did not make Scott Walker a target, did not charge him with anything. There were no legal consequences to him as a result of the John Doe. And so the fact that the same prosecutor who has, in a sense, proven that he's not out to get Walker is now engaging in a second John Doe that appears to have some evidence about Walker's participation in this sort of coordination, I think that gives a little bit more credibility to this. And so it's more than just two politicians screaming at each other.
And so if you're the Walker campaign at this point, is there something more that you ought to be doing than what they're doing now? Or is the status quo for them simply staying above the fray and letting this play out on its own?
I think we now understand the rumor that had happened about 2 weeks ago that the Walker campaign was in plea bargain negotiations with the prosecutor. And that was a story that sort of came and went in one news cycle. It was easy to miss. But now that we see this email, and now that we see a more half-baked or half-developed case against Walker or Walker's campaign and the other independent spenders, that suggests to us that if he had a more personal involvement, unlike the John Doe one, then in that case, it is more serious and it might have more political implications.
John Doe, by its nature, is supposed to be a secret investigation. Does the release of these documents while this investigation is halted, does it have a chilling effect on future John Doe efforts?
Gosh, Mitch, I really think you're onto something. This has been so bizarre because usually John Doe's begin in secret or current secret and then end with either an adjournment or with charges. The extremely aggressive legal tactics by the potential targets of it, Governor Walker, the legal tactics by the ones who might be accused of engaging in the coordination, has been so unusual that that's why we know about this. And that's why we're seeing these documents, which are, I have to just call them half-baked. In other words, it's not the completion of the John Doe. It's only the semi-development of the John Doe potentiality for an accusation.
Well, and so then what would happen to the John Doe should the case be allowed to continue?
Well, I guess if the case were to be allowed to continue, the prosecutors would continue to develop their case that there was a conspiracy to violate the ban on coordination, which may or may not have included Governor Walker, and which may lead to some charges. But I suspect that this would happen presumably after the November election rather than before, but that's purely a speculation on my part.
Well, we appreciate it anyway. Mordecai Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Mordecai Lee is a professor of governmental affairs at the UW-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education and a former state legislator. He is also a Lake Effect political analyst. We'll take a break now and switch from the hot air of politics to the somewhat cooler air of woodwind instruments. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. That's the sound of a woodwind quintet. Actually, despite the name, the ensemble is made up of just four woodwinds, flute, oboe, clarinet, and bassoon, and one brass instrument, the French horn. Milwaukee's Avec le Bois, the name translates to with the wood, are five young women who all come to the ensemble while also pursuing other careers in music. The group performs a recital tomorrow afternoon at St. Casimir Church in River West. Ahead of that performance, the young women spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North in Studio C1.
Ladies, welcome to Lake Effect. It is such a pleasure to have you here, and so nice of you to play for us.
Thank you for having us.
Would you please go around the room and introduce yourselves and tell us what you play?
Angela Cranes, I play flute and piccolo.
Hi, Rita Mitchell, I play oboe and English horn.
Allison Schweitzer, I'm the brass, the French horn.
I'm Elsa Nysak, and I play bassoon.
Christina Beaupre, and I play the clarinet.
You're all accomplished musicians. You all came to this only a few years ago, this particular quintet. How did it start? I mean, was it just like, gee, we need to do something different? I'm tired of playing symphony stuff.
Well, many of us knew each other already from playing in the area. I think the group that is most common to us in the group in this quintet is the Concord Chamber Orchestra. Many of us have played with that ensemble. But with Elsa, for instance, through the magic of social media, we managed to keep in touch since the Milwaukee Youth Symphony days, and we haven't really seen each other since
then.
More than a decade ago. And when we were looking to try out some music, we found her on Facebook, and it's been really fun, getting to know her again, 20 years later.
Oh, goodness.
In some case. Yeah.
Oh, that makes
since
sense
we started MISO. And then Christina was recommended to the group through another friend, and she's from out of town, so we didn't really know her, but she's a music teacher in the area, and we got to know her well, and we gel as a group, and it's been fun ever since.
There's a lot of wonderful repertoire for the Woodwind Quintet. Does this give you a chance to explore things that you wouldn't in other ensembles?
Yes, that's really true. I mean, that's what attracted me to the group. This is great repertoire that doesn't get to be played very often. And really, the other wonderful thing about this set of instruments is we aren't tied to a piano. So it gives us an opportunity to play in different places where we don't have to worry about, is there a piano or not, or do we need a pianist?
Do you know when the Woodwind Quintet first really came into being in terms of Western classical music? Was it like Haydn or a little later than that?
It would have had to be later because the clarinet didn't come around to being until later, the latter classical era and so forth.
So the earliest music, probably Mozart, maybe? Beethoven?
Beethoven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should have looked that up. I know a lot of the repertoire that we have played is late 19th, early 20th century. So I think there's been a lot written in that time period.
The colors of this, are, of course, are so interesting because you've got the four woodwinds and you have the fifth instrument, the horn. For you as musicians, what does working in this configuration do for you as musicians? You know, what do you hear here that you don't in a symphony or in another kind of larger configuration?
Well, I think that playing in the quintet, at least for me, gives us an opportunity to really hear each individual instrument's colors, give us a little bit more of a chance to be pseudo-soloistic in our playing and really take a lot more artistic leaps than you are in a traditional symphony orchestra where, you know, your purpose is to, you know, very much blend and, you know, create a unified sound. Here you're able to, you know, break out of that mold a little bit and create your own sound. So
what are rehearsals like then? I mean, you've got five very opinionated musicians who have an idea of how a piece needs to work. How do you guys negotiate all of that?
Well, we just start by playing it through and you know, we've got great camaraderie. So if someone wants to voice an opinion of maybe the tempo should be faster or let's, you know, work on this section, I don't think we've ever really had any huge disagreements about the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're opinionated, but we like each other, so we're going to be fine. Yeah, and I mean, we'll try different things too. I mean, we're willing to try tempos and take suggestions and work on things.
So, you know, phrasing and articulation and all of that is mm-hmm. something that you agree. Because, you know, as you're saying, you know, you get a chance to be more soloists mm-hmm. in this, but you also still have to make that cohesive sound. Mm-hmm. You still have to be the ensemble. Otherwise, it's five people sort of playing in opposite directions. Mm-hmm. And this is for everybody. What do you find the most challenging? Is it finding that unified sound or is it taking the risks in being the more solo, when you have that solo passage or when you have a chance, each instrument has a chance to shine?
I think for me, it's knowing when to stand out and when to blend. A lot of our music doesn't come with scores, so we have to go off of what we hear and then, you know, we compare our sheet music, but we don't get to see the big picture. It's challenging to know where you fall, when do you need to come out, who's leading where and when, and then creating that balance.
And for me as a horn player, I think my biggest challenge is like thinking like a woodwind and and playing back and playing lighter and just all the things that you expect out of a woodwind instrument I need to do. So it's a good challenge for me as a brass player. It's totally different from any other playing that I ever do.
So if you were in a brass quintet or sextet or something, mm-hmm. it's a very different kind of thing.
Yeah, it's all... Yeah. It seems to always be forte, always accented, always just very powerful. And here it's just so different. I like to compare the sound of the wooden quintet to a string ensemble sometimes. You know, we play similar types of music and it's just very airy. It's very light. It's breezy. Are there other words to describe that? It's not anything like a brass ensemble.
Favorite repertoire? Do you have favorite things you like to go back to or are you constantly looking for new things?
I think we have some definite standard go-to things like the Collamer, Bure, and things like that that we've played and have been received very well and that we enjoy playing a lot. But I know that, you know, with our group, we are pretty adventurous and we're willing to play just about anything. I mean, our own personal repertoire kind of spans from, you know, the Baroque. We have some Haydn pieces that we have worked up and some, you know, modern mid-century pieces as well as some more popular like the Colonel Bogey March and silly like folk tunes similar to that. So I feel like we're pretty we're pretty adventurous in what we like to try. So,
well, you're going to play a piece for us now. So would you tell me what it is and where this falls kind of in the repertoire?
I'm going to play the second movement of The Chimney of King René, which was written by Darius Milhaud. He wrote it in 1939. And we decided to play the second movement, which is titled Morning Serenade. And the piece itself is based on medieval tunes, but Darius Milhaud had his own sort of flavor of composing, so the chords don't quite match medieval music, which makes it very interesting.
All right. Well, here's Avec le Bois in Lake Effect's performance studio. That was Avec le Bois, and I'm going to ask you, because I don't have the sheet music in front of me, tell me again what we just heard.
It was the second movement of The Chimney of King René. The second movement is titled Morning Serenade.
Talk a little bit about the business side of what you do. I mean, musicians are always struggling to make a living. You know, this is I think it's been since time immemorial. Do you find that a quintet, you know, people are interested, that they want to book you, and, you know, and how difficult is it, to find bookings and to keep up with them?
I've actually been pretty surprised at the number of bookings that we've received. And this isn't our main job for any of us. We do have day jobs, so it's something we like to do for fun. But we have, played some holiday events and things like that. And just from people hearing us at these events, they'll contact us through our website. And so we've gotten quite a few jobs from that. So it's really just people that happen to hear us. So it's been a lot of fun and great that we've been able to get some jobs out of this.
Well, so what kind of jobs are there, like private parties and that sort of thing? So weddings?
Right. Weddings, yeah. Private corporate events, holiday parties, things like that.
So what is the event tomorrow? Is this just a recital, or is this a different sort of thing?
Tomorrow is just a recital. It's something we like to do for fun. We like to have at least one a year. So it's just a chance for us to work on some repertoire, new repertoire, and perform it for family and friends.
Looking into the future, what do you hope to do? Do you hope to take this full time?
Good question.
Well, that would always be nice, but I think right now for us, this is something that's really enjoyable. All of our personalities meld so well together, and our musical personalities as well meld so well together, that it's something that I know we all enjoy doing sort of on the side. If it could be more, I'm sure that we would all have an interest in that. But for right now, it's a fun venture for us all to be in.
And a way to explore a repertoire and get a chance to play.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I really can't thank you enough for taking time out of the day to come in and perform for us and tell us a little bit about you. I hope you'll stay in touch.
We'd love to.
Yes, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Avec Lebois is Christina Beaupré, clarinet, Elsa Nysack, bassoon, Angela Cranes, flute, Rita Mitchell, oboe, and Allison Schweitzer, French horn. The Milwaukee-based Woodwind Quintet performs a recital tomorrow afternoon at St. Casimir Church in River West. They spoke with Bonnie North, and the interview was engineered by John Strelecki. Another break now, and then there's more of Lake Effect in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke. If you're like the Lake Effect crew, you've been taking advantage of the nice weather, rain aside, to take to your bicycles. It is unlikely, though, that you'd be riding an old-fashioned high wheel or early tricycle down the streets, unless, of course, if you're on the streets of Old World, Wisconsin in Eagle. The Living History Museum has opened a new interactive experience it hopes will help participants catch wheel fever. Old World Director Dan Fries says participants get to ride an old-style tricycle and pose atop a replica high wheel while learning about the bicycling boom of the late 19th century. Fries and interpreter lead Ryan Schwartz gave Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce a preview of the experience, and Fries explains how the museum came up with this participatory feature.
We started to think about bicycling because we knew that bicycling was popular in Wisconsin back in the 19th century as well as today. So we thought it would be an interesting topic to explore as part of a new experience. And as we started to look into the history, we learned that a new book was about to be released by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press entitled Wheel Fever. And we began working with one of the authors, Nick Hoffman, to help us kind of think through what we might be able to do here at Old World that would introduce our guests to the bicycle fever that was sweeping Wisconsin back in the 1890s.
Tell us a little bit about that bicycle craze toward the end of the 19th century.
Bicycling had been around in Wisconsin for really just a very short period of time, but in the 1890s, a couple of things happened. First of all, the high wheel bicycles, when people envision old-fashioned bicycles, they usually think of the high wheel bicycles, and we have a couple of those as part of the experience that people can sit on and pedal, but they're stationary, so they can't go anywhere and they can't fall and hurt themselves. But right about that time in the 1890s, there started to be some advancements in the technology associated with cycling, and the new safety bicycles were coming out that were safer to ride, hence the name, and also more comfortable because they used air-filled pneumatic tires as opposed to the hard rubber tires. So it was really about comfort and safety that really made it much more accessible and more friendly to folks as far as getting involved in cycling.
Well, why don't we head into the experience?
Sure. So one of the first things as folks walk into the site, we knew from the very beginning that the real draw here was going to be the bicycle riding activity. So inside the shed, we have a variety of stations that we've set up to occupy people and engage them in exploring bicycling history while they're waiting their turn to ride on a bicycle. And as you enter the shed, one of the things that we've done is, again, we're trying to keep everything within the context of the 1890s. So instead of having a modern sign out here saying, you are now entering Catch Wheel Fever, we've disguised the orientation to the experience as a 19th century looking broadside. So it gives you all the information that you need to know as far as the fact that it's the Badger Wheelman Cycling Club, which incidentally was a real cycling club in Milwaukee in the late 19th century. And they're meeting here today. They've essentially taken over this shed as their meeting location. And while you're in here, you know, interacting with them, there you can have your portrait taken with you and your bicycle. We mentioned that all ages are welcome because from the very beginning we wanted this to be an experience that was as much for adults as well as kids. And again, just trying to encourage people to come in and to explore this wheel fever.
This was a craze that swept the country. What did it look like here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think Wisconsin, to some extent, mirrored what was going on in the rest of the country. I think the thing that made a big difference here in Wisconsin was very quickly the bicycling movement equated into improvements in the road system. And one of the reasons people come to Wisconsin today to ride bicycles is because, you know, the great roads out in the rural countryside, and it was very similar back in the 19th century. The other thing is because we had already established a good manufacturing basis in particularly southeastern Wisconsin, as soon as the bicycling craze hit, all of a sudden you had factories in Milwaukee and Kenosha and other places beginning to manufacture bicycles and bicycle parts. And so all the stuff that you needed for cycling was very readily available.
Was it different out in the frontier, in some of the less established places like what Old World Wisconsin represents?
Yeah, bicycling was really more of an urban activity. And even when it did take place out in rural areas, it was, for example, a club like the Badger Wheelmen coming out from Milwaukee to ride on the country roads. It wasn't a local bicycle club located in Eagle, Wisconsin. So it was still very, very urban-oriented in terms of who was riding bicycles. Now, as you got into the 20th century, that changed, and it didn't take very long before people all over Wisconsin, both urban and rural, were riding on bicycles.
Well, so Ryan, can you give us an introduction here into the Badger Wheelmen Cycling Club's headquarters here?
Yeah, please, come on in. Of course, as you come in, if you listen closely, you can hear some examples of late 1890s cycling music. Because, of course, as Dan mentioned, that when these clubs were going out into the countryside, they would go in large groups together, and it was considered a very social affair. And so as they ride along, they're riding along in a big group, and they would sing, of course, as they went along, something as entertainment as well as looking at the sights all around. And so I think that's the first thing that people will notice when they come in, is that when they step through the door, just as you guys did, you will start to recognize that you're kind of stepping away from our current modern time period and back into what it would have been like in the 1890s, because you're getting not only the sights of one of these club halls, but as well as the sounds.
And Ryan, I see that there's this great sign over here, talk like a wheelman. Was there specific language that was used?
Yeah, there was a definite lingo that they would have had back in this time period. For instance, we always warn guests not to take a header, because taking a header means they're going to flip over the handlebars and get hurt, which thankfully there's no real risk of that because we're riding tricycles here as opposed to the high wheel bicycles that they'll see in a moment.
And yes, I see one of these high-wheel bicycles behind us. I mean, this is, kind of when I think of old-timey bicycles, this is what I'm thinking of. Is that maybe a mistake that's kind of immediately where my mind goes?
I don't think so, because the high-wheel bicycle was the first sort of bicycle that really started to take hold in the United States. Before that, they had something called a velocipede, which was also known as a bone shaker. That was one of their terminologies, is that a bone shaker was a very rough vehicle that didn't have a very smooth ride. The first time you could really start getting a smooth ride on a bicycle was with these high wheels. And so high wheels were very expensive, though, so that's why, again, it's an urban sort of a thing. So only people in the city could usually afford them. It wasn't until you started seeing the safety bicycles that it became generally affordable for a lot of people. So you started seeing these in the 1880s and early 1890s.
Looking at this high wheel bicycle, it looks so strange to us today, but really the mechanics seem very similar. Is that kind of one of the themes you're going for, is that there really is a connection today to the activities of yore?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and one of the things that we want people to notice is the technology associated with the bicycles. And with the high wheel bicycle, I mean, the rider is sitting directly above the pedals. The one thing that you'll notice is there's no chain. There's no opportunity to actually move the gearing back underneath where the rider sits. And that changed in the 1890s with the chain drive that was used on the newer, what they called safety bicycles. And we have an example of a safety bicycle here in the shed. And this is actually a bicycle that was manufactured in Kenosha. So it's a locally made bicycle made in 1899 by the Sterling Company. But as you can see, that one of the things that changed from the high wheel to the safety bicycle is the fact that the rider can now, with the chain drive, move back farther on the bicycle and kind of be centered a little bit more over the two wheels. So it's a much more stable, safer, and hence the name, ride than what you'd get on the high wheel.
Was the experience of bicycling different between men and women, especially, you know, as that technology changed?
Oh, certainly, certainly. Of course, if you're familiar at all with the look of a high-wheel bicycle, you know it's very difficult for a lady who has to wear these long, flowing dresses in order to ride with proper dignity. It's very difficult to imagine a woman in proper dress actually getting on and riding one of these things. But when the safety bicycle started to appear, which doesn't look too much different than what many people ride today, it became much more possible. And you also saw the advent of the tricycle, which, again, we have available for guests to ride here. That would have been more of a vehicle that women would ride. And you also started to see this as a part of a social revolution among women as well. Frances Willard, who lived for a while in the Janesville area, she was a very vocal advocate of the women's rights movement. And she wrote a whole book about how she enjoyed riding bicycles because she believed it was part of a woman's liberation movement. And so bicycles took a very key role in women's rights in this time period.
Well, why don't you show us this tricycle you have over here? It looks like it's a double tricycle.
Yeah, this is essentially made for children. It's a two-seater. As you can see in the back, you have the position where maybe an older child would be able to sit and be able to pedal. And then up front, you have a much smaller seat for a much smaller child. And this is an actual original artifact that we have also started to fix up and make it look like it would have back in the olden days. We've reupholstered it and added a new rubber tire onto the front. But this is something that we recovered and saved out of Pennsylvania, and we brought here because we thought it would show an interesting way that children would have been able to ride these sort of vehicles. eBay was really helpful because, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, that's how we happened to get a hold of this one. We found an ad for it.
And the Sterling, yeah.
Also were found via eBay. And then we're working with South Shore Bicycle, I believe, to restore the safety bike.
Well, what's this display over here? It looks like a bicycle repair shop, an early bicycle repair shop.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. We actually based this off of an image that we found that came out of Oshkosh. And it shows a very typical bicycle repair shop. You have a lot of the common items that you would have found in such a place. You, of course, have your shelvings for all of your accoutrement, if you prefer. It has your oil cans and all of your tools. You also have a vise where you'd be working on things like putting the pedals together that you'd use on one of these bicycles. You have a pneumatic pump, which again is a new innovation in the 1890s. The idea that you can have tires that will actually inflate and won't throw you off of the bicycle at the slightest rock in the road. In fact, most of your listeners will be familiar with Michelin tires. Came out of France. They actually got their start in pneumatic tires, making tires for bicycles, and then later, of course, transitioned into automobile tires.
One of the other things that we're doing with the workbench area is really bringing into a history story the idea of science and technology, because oftentimes history museums kind of ignore the fact that there was science and technology associated with the past. And this allows us to bring in some hands-on activities that our guests may have seen before, but maybe in a more traditional science museum environment, but we can place them into the historical context of 1890s Wisconsin and weave it into the historical story about cycling.
But of course, the highlight of this experience is getting to go and ride the bicycles. So why don't we head on out?
Sure. Are you ready to ride one?
I'm a little nervous, actually.
Why don't we have Ryan demonstrate how to get on and off one of these, and then we'll give you an opportunity to take a spin yourself.
Sounds great.
Okay, so the best way to do this is once you have the tricycle in front of you, there's going to be a bar that you're going to have to step over, and that will place you directly behind the handlebars. So once you're in this position, you can put two hands on the handlebars and put a foot back on one of the pedals.
These are wooden block pedals, it looks like.
Yes, these are wooden block pedals, nothing metal, nothing to actually hold your feet in place, so this is definitely not made for racing. So what you can do is you can put your foot back on that block pedal and you're just going to push yourself up onto the seat. Because if you're sitting on top of it, if you're at the right size for it, your feet should be hanging about 2 or 3 inches off the ground. Now, these have a very basic drive chain, so it makes the ride a little bit easier for you. But then once you're up, all you do is you push off, and away you go.
All right, I'm up, and now
it takes a little bit of a push.
A little bit of a push. Oh, my goodness. Ah!
Dan Fries is director of Old World Wisconsin and Eagle, and Ryan Schwartz is interpreter lead for the Living History Museum's new interactive experience, Catch Wheel Fever, now open to the public. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce, who is currently still riding that tricycle, and was assisted by interns Audrey Nowakowski and Brooke Dowden. Old World Wisconsin will also be hosting a special event July 19th featuring the Wheelmen, a group of antique bicycling enthusiasts. Visitors can sign up to take a 10-mile ride alongside these high-wheel bikes, watch a mock high-wheel bicycle race, or watch demonstrations. And if you just can't get enough of old-timey bicycles, you can also enter to win one of several editions of the new Wisconsin Historical Society Press's Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State. You can go to wuwm.com/contests to enter. That is Friday's edition of Lake Effect, produced by the team of Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with web support from Michelle Maternowski, engineering from John Strelecki, and production assistance from the growing team of Eleanor Peterson, Brooke Dowden, and Audrey Nowakowski. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7. WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next at 11 o'clock. And then at noon, it's Here and Now.